This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Matt Pegan, and we're going to be discussing the ongoing nationwide riots. Matt, great talking to you, and this actually hits you personally because you're in L.A., and all these major things happen throughout L.A. over the last couple days, like this riots and looting. The whole Melrose, Fairfax area, kind of where the Grove is, into Beverly Hills, and then over in Santa Monica, like including like the Third Street Promenade.
Yeah, no, I started following these riots when they were just in Minneapolis on Wednesday, Thursday, and then by Friday they'd hit downtown. And at that time, you remember because I was talking to you, I'd hoped or even just predicted that they wouldn't get as bad here, but the reality is, I mean, it probably wasn't as bad as Minneapolis, which my understanding was certain neighborhoods were practically razed to the ground.
There's never been anything like this in modern history.
Yeah, the riots of 92 never hit homes in that way. Point. I didn't think it would get as bad here, but I mean, it really has been quite a travesty between the Grove getting looted and Melrose, Fairfax. I drove all around these areas yesterday. I should say the protests are largely quieted down for now in LA as of the 3rd of June when we're recording this. NYC seems to be the new.
Yeah, we're recording this the 3rd of, it's the 3rd of June, so when this post gets posted, it might be slightly dated, but as of today, the 3rd, the LA does seem to be simmering down, and the really bad stuff, see, New York is still really bad. Yesterday, there was looting in the heart of Midtown Manhattan, all the really like high-end department stores.
Yeah, I've only dug a little bit through the videos and the posts, but seemingly NYC has gotten as bad as anywhere else, and it's extra shocking, of course, because it's Manhattan. You know, I've grown up. I'm a child of the '90s. I've kind of grown up looking at New York as a success story of a city that really got back on its feet, where there's really not a lot of crime, but it's bad in New York. Discounting 9/11, which is another story.
Yeah, but, just to think like how we went to all these like really catastrophic wars over something that was only, 9/11 was a tragedy, but it was a fraction of what's going on now, and we went into these catastrophic wars, so that's something to really to think about. But yeah, Midtown Manhattan really represents, it's like, if you could think of one place in the world as like the capital center of power of the entire world, it would be Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I still have to figure out exactly the extent of what happened there last night. But it's up there with D.C., which we'll talk about, the protests there, and the defacing of war memorials and the burning of St. John's Church. All of that is highly symbolically and materially relevant. But right up there with D.C. and Trump going to bunker is the destruction of Manhattan.
Yeah, it does look like something out of a war zone that you would see like in somewhere in the Middle East. But I do want to like to go back and look at the social trends that led up to this event. So the economy is a huge factor, and that's being ignored by both sides, because the left is focusing more on the whole narrative of white racism and what happened with the police. And then the conservatives are just focusing on the bad behavior coming from the rioters or the looters. But you do have to kind of go back. And yeah, people just have, like, when this first happens, everyone's going to have their visceral, emotional reaction. But just looking at it in a kind of less moralistic stance, like what events led to this. So yeah, I mean, the economy is huge. Very, not enough people are talking about this in the media. Like the massive layoffs. Major economists, mainstream economic news sources are predicting that about 40% of the jobs that are lost are not coming back. They're permanently gone. And yeah. That is catastrophic.
That is absolutely catastrophic. And Robert, you bring up a good point. I mean, we were going to do this show a few days ago, and I have these 7 pages of notes in front of me. I've had, not to get all emo and liberal about things, but I've just had so many thoughts and feelings about this over the days. It's been, I think it's been traumatic for a lot of Americans to witness all of this. So I say all that to say that I've certainly had a strong gut emotional reaction.
Yeah, like when we were first talking on the phone about this, we were joking that your response was more kind of how a boomer, MAGA boomer would respond.
I definitely fell in that direction, and in some ways I still do, and we'll get to that. I think there's relevant things to be discussed there. I think that this is kind of a moment to, consider how we can tunnel towards, just average American conservatives, because I think they're as horrified by this as us. I still think that's relevant. But in the early days, definitely, I didn't want to do a show expressing some of those sentiments. It was kind of a combination of, I'll just be honest, much more openly kind of fashy and racist sentiments. I definitely felt those, as well as that, and also kind of more of a MAGA boomer sentiment. I mean, those are the only terms I could think in initially. And, I mean, you bring up a good point. Like, people, and also, Kant Bot's show with Indian Bronson, they talked about this in an interesting way, about how kind of people just revert back to their basics in times of crisis. And I was definitely no exception to that. And I'm just trying to kind of think through now, the best response to have to all of this. And there's just, I still have so many thoughts and feelings, but we had to do a show. But I'm talking in circles here. To get to your point, yes, the economy is a huge factor. There's a lot of things that are being said, right? In terms on both sides, there's a lot of things being said, that are more conservative points being made, and then obviously on the left side, the black squares making all of this about the death of one person, these racial grievances, all of that. There's a lot of things being said, but underneath, and a lot of those things being said are relevant to the discussion that these are real factors. But at the same time, there's so much that's not being said. And one of those things is absolutely the economy that we've been pent up for months, is the fact that people are out of jobs, out of occupation, that there's a general nihilism, that there's a general sense that things, that anything can happen now, and that, and you know.
Yeah, so it's really hard to underestimate impacts of this. Yeah, the pent up rage of the lockdowns and, I mean, there was a whole debate about the lockdowns, and I don't really want to focus too much on the virus. I mean, well, the virus definitely is relevant, but about the whole debate back and forth about the lockdowns is because I do think that with the reopening, there could be like an increase in the virus, the pandemic. But I also think that it is really difficult to control people and to get them to comply. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of rage about the just being inside all day, and I mean, there's just a lot of pent up rage. I mean, the economy is the big thing with mm-hmm. the mass layoffs, and then going back to prior to this, just the kind of policies that have led to this. So if you look at the protests, the riots, age profile is they're mostly Gen Z, so. Yeah, I mean, most of them are, like, the core age is between mm-hmm. 18 and 25, maybe some a little bit older. And I think what's crucial, and this applies to millennials as well, but just the combination of the policy, like neoliberalism, like the combo of debt, no job prospects. But then you kind of combine that with the racial grievance culture and just kind of class grievance culture in university. So, like, what Bernie was talking about, how, like, the banks, it's just this weird kind of combination. So Bernie was right about how the banks were screwing over the students with student debt, and how neoliberalism and the oligarchy, you could say, has screwed over so many young people from, I mean, it's a pretty wide class range. Like, you have, there's the kind of like stereotype of the Antifa on a trust fund, and those types do exist, but I do think a lot of it is just economic rage. Like, there are black people from the proletariat, and then there's also white middle class people who are joining in because they're economically devastated. So economic factors are, but then you take that economic factor and then you combine that with, like, the radical grievance culture in universities, and a conspiracy-minded person might say that those two trends are intentional, but I'm just saying that's basically the combination of those two. And I also think that people who are left-wing economically were totally black-pilled by Bernie's defeat.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the left and a lot of Bernie supporters who were more focused on economic issues and creating a coalition of different races, different walks of life. I mean, they have to be, and I think they largely are, disappointed by this, because what you have is basically a kind of a left-wing energy in society happening right now, but it's kind of being swooped up by corporations and, you know, totally about this one Black Lives Matter issue. I don't see this as a protest that...
A perfect example about this is that there is that Twitter account, Woke Capital, and the Twitter account is posting these posts, like Twitter posts from these big corporations. And the thing is, like, these corporations have contributed to economic problems with extreme income inequality, but they're also virtue signaling in favor of the cause about, like, how Woke Capital kind of it exploits people economically, but at the same time contributes to the grievance culture.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, that's a big thing. But the thing is, like, kind of talking about kind of crossover, like a third position crossover between dissident left and dissident right. And, like, I'm following, like, I'm on my Twitter feed, I notice, like, I have people who are more left-wing Bernie supporters and more right-wing people. I follow both. And it's creating more, it's just further polarizing the two, because there's this kind of stance between, like, the right-wing stance of law and order versus a lot of leftists who are, like, we can get to people, like, the kind of anti-woke left, and their stance is more nuanced. But I do see a stronger polarization between the right, who wants to establish order against the riots, and then people who are left-wing populist who are sympathetic to the cause, who see it as opposed to the oligarchy and the police state. So I think in some ways, I think it will lead to more economic polarization. And in that sense, that's one factor. But then on the other hand, a lot of people who are getting harmed by the riots are from more, like, small business owners who are maybe, and homeowners who may be Democrats, but those are people who are more kind of conventional, so maybe more conventional moderate Democrats might become more conservative. Yeah, it's just kind of hard to say how it will impact these political realignments.
Yeah, no, very hard to say indeed right now. The stats came out that a majority would be in favor of calling the National Guard as backup for the riots, but also a more slight, but nevertheless a majority, a slighter majority, but nevertheless a majority are would say that the anger behind the protests is justified.
Yeah,
and Trump is polling worse now. So
we'll definitely get to Trump's performance. I found this chart that shows the opinions based on different demographics. So, I mean, here's another kind of interesting thing, is there is the kind of class war angle, like the rioters going to Beverly Hills and graffitiing Eat the Rich. But the thing is, actually, it does show wealthier people are ironically, and I mean, it's not ironic to kind of to a lot of dissidents, but I think to the mainstream it is ironic. It shows actually wealthier people more sympathetic than the working class. And even though they went, it is shocking that they went into wealthier areas, I think disproportionately it will be have a worse impact on the working class. And then there was our...
these things have a worse impact on the working class than the middle class. They're brick and mortar, street level businesses that are getting looted. Now, in other instances, it is, like at the Grove, it is going to be more big corporation businesses. Any large corporation can sustain the blow of one shop, one or two shops getting looted, or an Amazon truck getting looted. They put nothing on the line. They make no sacrifice. A company like Amazon or any of the other myriad of huge companies who are now virtue signaling, they put nothing on the line by saying they stand in solidarity with the protests. It's hypocritical. Whereas it really is normal Americans, middle class, working class, who are negatively affected by this, the people who live in cities who are negatively affected by this, and also just the people observing who are absolutely terrorized by seeing people, you know, burning American flags, waving Mexican flags, Black Lives Matter flags, explicitly anti-white rhetoric. These are the people that are explicitly targeted by a lot of the protests, and these are the people who are the most sort of traumatized or negatively affected by it. I think Tucker Carlson, what he said on Monday night was on point, that this is basically an insurrection of people who have contributed nothing to building the country against, in their crosshairs are just normal Americans, and the elites, the political elites, as well as corporations are completely and utterly fucking us over.
Yeah, I think with the more kind of establishment, like Democrats and woke capital, I mean, they've contributed to the climate, but on both the economic angle and cultural angle. But I do think that they think that if they're seen as, maybe they want to portray themselves as different, more woke than the oppressive power structure, that could be like their strategy. But I just don't see that working.
I don't see it working. I think it's literally, it's just the cool thing to do right now.
Yeah, so you see all these like affluent liberal white women on Instagram, and they'll have like that picture in Santa Monica where the Instagram influencer is having her boyfriend photograph her in front of the looted store, and a lot of just like the virtue signaling on Instagram among especially like affluent liberal white women.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And look, we've seen all of this before. We've seen it in 2015, 2016, and obviously after. As well, the virtue signaling class, the economy of virtue signaling that emerges after any cultural event like this, where everyone's floundering to have the best woke take. We're just the sad and the one of the major black pills about this all this is that we're not moving past it, and rather it's coming out as this much higher stakes thing with protests and violence, much higher stakes much higher stakes at the street level, much more dangerous at the street level, and much more of devolving into self-parody on the social media woke white level.
Like, people I respected, like, I was an Andrew Yang supporter, I do think Yang is right on the economic level, like, about the basic income. So I do think, like, if we were to... Yeah, like if there was a stronger basic income, that could have eased the situation. And Yang was right in his book, like The War on Normal People, how he predicted that mass layoffs due to automation would lead to more civil unrest, more like worse race relations. So Yang is 100% right on that level.
Yeah.
But I was Yang was going along with the kind of usual woke virtue signaling.
Yeah, well, look, one of the things I wrote in my notes is that, times like this, moments of crisis, and this isn't, you know, how much of a moment of crisis is this? Is it a full-on moment of crisis? Either way, it gives us at least a dry run of what it would be like if shit hit the fan. And when things like that happen, it really is a big reminder about who your friends are and who your enemies are. And especially on this show and elsewhere on the dissident right, like, there's a lot to be learned from people on the dissident left, on the anti-neoliberal left. But with many good exceptions, you know, Anna Tachyon, that crowd, I'm not really taking issue with anything they've said about this. But so with exceptions, I think that things like this kind of remind you that for as smart as a lot of kind of left-leaning people are, at when the shit hits the fan, if you're a person of the right or of a conservative or nationalistic bent, they are the enemy. And we see that, that they align themselves with the other side, that basically no matter how good their takes might be, they align themselves with the other sides. Now, on the Andrew Yang issue, on the other hand, I still think that there is a lot of value to him in particular, because he has provided such outside-the-box perspectives on a lot of the social unrest, so there's still a lot of value to be garnered there. But overall, it's a moment of like severe disillusionment for me, for people who would side with the riots.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is kind of an exposure to basically, you could say, almost like a reality pill, because the kind of, like, the way, like, if you look at these big urban areas like L.A., like, there's the, from the right-wing angle, there's a demographic angle, and then the more kind of left-wing argument that just the extreme income inequality in a place like L.A. is unsustainable, and just how our society, like, America as a whole, is just such a massive decline in social capital, a breakdown, and, like, different, like, dissident thinkers, that, including dissident left, or left-wing people who are more sympathetic to what's going on, and dissident right people who are not, but both sides have been making the case that the way society is unsustainable, and it's bound, like, Peter Turchin is, so he's been writing, he's written a lot about that, and I recommend checking out Turchin's work about this. He predicted, like, a breakdown society, like, at least a decade ago, if not more, and the thing is, you have these people in, like, the upper middle class who are kind of, like, upper middle class center left types, kind of like bourgeois liberalism. I'm sure to them it's such a shock because they've lived in such a bubble.
Yes and no, but a lot of those bourgeois liberal people are basically supporting the protests at the same time.
Yeah,
I'm sure
it is
shocking
for
them, but the way that they're dealing with it is to align themselves with it, which is quite astonishing. One another thing I wrote in my notes is I think that the degree to which you can kind of see the pipeline of power, or at least coalitional power, between woke capital, between bourgeois white liberals and bourgeois liberals in general, between those upper class liberals, right on down to the common street criminal, I think is visible in a truly stunning way right now. And it will get glossed over in the days ahead as certain kind of center left influencers like Joe Biden nab the right line about condemning looting and violence while supporting the protests. Like, things will get glossed over, but in the meantime, I really think you can see the kind of power dynamic. I mean, I'm reminded of Ann Coulter's 2011 book Demonic, about the mob and the mob as an organ of left-wing power, and I don't think it's too hyperbolic to say that you can really see how, you know, mob violence is connected with the sentiments, at least, if not the outright political power, of the mainstream of the Democratic Party and of woke capital.
I mean, the kind of relationship or the contrast between left-wing anarchism and bourgeois liberalism. So, yeah, bourgeois liberalism is, yeah, they're basically scared to criticize the extreme left. I mean, that's what's happening now, and a lot of them are virtue signaling. But they're the people who could least likely, like, the softest people when it comes to handling this kind of chaos. But the kind of coalition, it'll be interesting, the coalition between bourgeois liberalism and woke capital in the more radical left.
Look, I don't think that coalition between the radical left and the mainstream left will last. I just think it's completely transparent. The mask is completely slipped right now, in the sense that these people, while they definitely don't agree on everything, they have one common goal, and that is anti-whiteness and anti-normal American sentiments, and being in favor of dismantling the power represented by, and I'm not praising the Republican Party here, but the power represented by Republican, non-diverse America. They differ on a lot, the radical left and the mainstream left, but right now, With the rioting on one hand and the virtue signaling on the other, you can see that on that point they are in complete agreement. And we already knew this. That's the thing. We already knew this. It's a kind of traumatic, bringing to light of this stuff.
So yeah, just the other concrete factors impacting this besides the economy is it's hard to jail people with the pandemic, and there have already been releases of people. Out of jail, and what they're doing is that, I mean, so in LA, and it applies to other cities like New York as well, so because there's such a high risk of the virus in jail, they do is the arrestees put them on a bus, and they basically get their mugshot, they check their information, put them in the database, and then basically in the morning they let them go. And a lot of these people will continue the rioting the next day. So, yeah, I mean...
Combine that with the recent crusades to free felons in light of coronavirus and also Kushner's whole thing. Then what you have is, yeah, we're going to... I predict that even if direct rioting dies down in the coming days, it probably will. But, I mean, it's hard not to see crime going up indefinitely from here.
Yeah, so... And comparing the situation in L.A. to the 91 riots, those actually stayed in lower-income areas. I think the farthest they got was to, like, the area, like, around Wilshire and La Brea. Or maybe it was, like, Pico and La Brea, I'm not 100% sure. So it got kind of on the border of, like, very close to the nicer areas. And there was this, I mean, there was this big fear. But then they basically were, the police pushed it back. And this time is, I mean, this is totally...
dynamics
this is totally
are...
different. And a lot, I mean, it is important. Because interesting, like, what you're saying about how kind of bourgeois liberals would react to this. Because for a lot of people who live in, like, places like Santa Monica, like, they, not so much... Like, you're saying you do have, like, the Instagram influencers supporting this. But I do think, like, I'd say... like an upper middle class boomer liberal living in Santa Monica is probably utterly shocked.
Yeah. I mean, we don't exactly know yet what the reactions will be. They're probably utterly shocked, but there's also Robert. I mean, there's a lot of people that are going to be utterly shocked, but still post the black square, still virtue signaling.
Yeah. I mean, there's been businesses that have been destroyed and they're still virtue signaling. So I don't know if it's their moral conviction or it could very well be, more just out of fear that they're appeasing the rioters. Well, I mean, we're also seeing it spread into the suburbs, which is, I mean, that's never really happened. So about 2 days ago, there was looting in Walnut Creek, and that area really epitomizes, like, white upper middle class suburbia in the Bay Area.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, there's and I've seen this play out in real time on Twitter, going to the latest function and looking up a neighborhood, and you see people specifically targeting or ask that certain areas be looted or rioted in because they're, because they're upper class areas, but also I just see because they're white areas, you know, that these are very targeted attacks. And I drove down Ventura Boulevard yesterday and you see all the boarded up, or I saw all the boarded up shops, and a lot of them had, you know, BLM written on it or minority owned business on the front, kind of a la the lamb's blood and the angel of death in that part of the Bible. I mean, we have to be honest about the racialization of a lot of these attacks. And it's in this specifically anti-white insurrection, basically, as V. Deer has been saying.
One thing I noticed is that there's an area on Westwood Boulevard. And I originally grew up in this area. I mean, that's a very wealthy area. And I saw there's a Persian owned business that has a big sign that says, that's basically says, like, POC owned businesses. So there's groups that are very successful in LA, they still want to be seen as part of that kind of POC coalition.
Yeah, and I'm not blaming them.
Yeah, I mean, they're just trying to save their business. I don't blame them.
Look, you see people talking about Kristallnacht, and obviously that's inflammatory language. I think these people have anything like the resources that, you know, that the Nazi party did at that time, right? It's not a great analogy. However, we have to, like, we cannot sugarcoat the fact that people and businesses are being targeted explicitly for their race. Yes, because of their class, but also because of their race. And
well, the whole kind of debate about like about you do have like more affluent POCs. So like there was a comedian who was South Asian. And I mean, South Asians tend to be they have a higher per capita income than even whites. But you do have like that South Asian comedian saying something kind of inflammatory about targeting white suburbs.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's it. I mean, yeah, you have that from woke blue checks, in this case, an immigrant blue check. But you have it at the street level. I mean, people are going to try and sugarcoat this. But you go to these protests and you see what they're saying. And a lot of it is racialized targeting and this radical left politics, which a lot of people, that has a positive connotation. But in this case, what they're trying to destroy is not capitalism for its own sake. They're trying to take down white Western civilization.
Yeah. I mean, the target is it's not the power elite. It's just ordinary middle class Americans.
Yeah, no, 100%. And there's some well-meaning people probably in the protests who would say like, oh yeah, we really got to take down the 1%. But I mean, those voices are not coming out. And rather, it's the same people. These are the same people that, and I've seen this during the coronavirus stuff, the same people that like when Huntington Beach trends because there's some kind of anti-lockdown protest, which I don't support anti-lockdown protests either, but nevertheless, when it trends because of an anti-lockdown protest, when Simi Valley trends because of such a thing, all these people are like, these areas are irredeemably racist and awful shitholes, and what they're saying that because it's the white majority population. I mean, there's no sugarcoating the fact that a lot of people just hate the idea of white people who live around other white people.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true, but the thing is a lot of, I mean, the area of Minneapolis that was devastated was very diverse, including, like, the white people who lived there were very, very liberal, and a lot of immigrants and POCs, they were harmed by it. So as far as their agenda, like, who they view as the enemy, versus basically who gets harmed by it. What would be interesting is, like, as far as, like, political implications, do you think it could be a blow to a kind of class-sympathetic nationalism? Like, kind of people talk about nationalism with left-wing economics, because unfortunately, yeah. I think it will just be more further polarization between, like, the right-wing capitalist boomer Republican versus the radical leftist. I think it could actually push the political dichotomy more in that type of traditional polarization.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're feeling all these things right now, and the conversation may be different in a month. Maybe things will go relatively back to at least a new normal. But yeah, in the meantime, the kind of red-pilled Bernie bro crowd, quote-unquote, I mean, where are they in this?
Like, there's a lot of accounts on Twitter who I'm generally sympathetic for in their narrative. I mean, they do have that kind of narrative on this event, which, I mean, I'm not really crazy about, but the thing is, like, Zaid Jilani, who is part of the whole kind of anti-woke left scene, he made this point that the ultra-wealthy they're rarely impacted by that. Basically, it will be, I mean, it will be sort of like the middle class who will bear the brunt, the petty bourgeois small business owners. I mean, you made this point earlier, but Amazon will do fine. The top mm-hmm. the top wealthiest will be fine as well. I mean, it's an attack on the white middle class. It's also
the intention function that is what the baser elements of the people joining in are expressing openly on social media and on the streets. Even just the more intellectualized calls to like defund the police, which I mean, that isn't a radical extreme position. But it's that I don't know about every extreme position expressed these rights, but to defund the police is a rallying cry you hear across the country. What would that mean? And I'd actually like to hear from someone who's in favor of that how that would work. But basically, what that sounds to me is the police are there to protect normal people, to protect more vulnerable people as well, of course, and. What they basically want is mob rule.
Yeah. So, with the police, a lot of leftist After that, I mean, after the past police brutality incidents and the riots, like in Ferguson, they were advocating more for community policing. But ironically, I think with community policing, that actually kind of vindicates a more kind of neo-tribal position, that basically you trust police, government agents if they're of their community. So, yeah, I mean, I'm actually sympathetic to community policing, but the idea of, like, defunding the police, yeah, I mean, that's insane in a time like that. I mean, there are problems with police brutality, or just mm-hmm. the kind of general, attitude. Like, even middle-class white people have bad experiences with police just being flat-out arrogant, and a lot of that is just positions of people with power will always abuse their power, but it also just reflects the kind of overall breakdown in social capital. How if there's no genuine organic communities, then a stronger state will have to fill in that void. So that's a big thing. But I do think lot of these riots, like it's not so much a clear angle. It's more about the opportunist creating chaos, and just kind of the overall like rage about but their own situation, but there's no like clear, coherent political message. So I wouldn't even say it's not even like a traditional revolution. It's just chaos.
Yeah, no, it certainly is that.
And then on to Trump's handling. I'm critical of Trump, but I also acknowledge he's in a very difficult situation, because he is kind of the worst of mm-hmm. both worlds, because the left and the protesters, they basically view him as a fascist, but he's been kind of a little bit kind of going back and forth, because he had that tweet where his initial tweet was just, he wrote law and order. That's all he said. That was it. And yeah, everyone was making fun of that. Then he went out and gave that speech, and his speech, it wasn't a terrible speech. It was okay. You have to kind of look at past presidents, because I think even like past presidents who were from the establishment would have handled it better. So look at how Obama handled the Ferguson riots. He was, from a right-wing standpoint, Obama was probably more soft, but at least because he was well-respected, he used his political capital to de-escalate the situation, and because they view Trump as a fascist, Trump obviously has no credibility with them. And then I do think the more kind of generic, more traditional establishment presidents like Bush and Clinton, I mean, I'm definitely no fan of George Bush or Bill Clinton, but I do think, but just putting aside politics, just kind of the overall leadership skills.
I would think maybe they would do a better job, not because their views are better at all, but just because they have more political skills, and also during their respective terms, especially were probably at least maybe not Bush, but definitely Obama and even Clinton, you know, better regarded by people who would be protesting, who would be rioting, and that helps. So Trump can't really do anything about that. That is kind of just a broader reflection of the division within our society, which is not Trump's fault. It existed long before Trump, it just has to do with demographic change and these things. I mean, we're fast approaching a point where you have a minority of Americans who are sympathetic to Republican-type positions, who can maybe jockey to get the to win the electoral college and win the presidency, but you basically have a growing majority of people who don't view Republican positions, conservative positions as meriting any air. Like they just think that it's all racist and should be abolished. And I mean that's what we're seeing.
Yeah,
right,
that's
now.
Kind of interesting about narratives about racism, because I do remember when Charlottesville happened, like basically mainstream white people, the bourgeois liberals and the more kind of the mainstream conservatives, they all kind of ganged up and they view that the alt-right as these evil Nazis. But kind of basically what happened is how the alt-right became the symbol for everything. Like basically the alt-right became a symbol for basically all the horrible things, racial atrocities that happened throughout American history. But with these, with the protest, they don't even see that as an issue. They basically view all of American society as a whole as racist and oppressive, which is, I mean, that's an interesting change in the dichotomy.
Well, it's an interesting change in the narrative, but I mean, it's always been clear that that's what they were saying. I mean, I remember the protests after Trump got elected in 2016, where I was, where, you know, no ban, no wall on stolen land. I mean, the left has, the left in America has, the mainstream left likes to point the finger at the alt-right and such, but the, for lack of a better word, the dissident left has been very firm on this point for some time, you know, at least since I was in college, that pretty much America itself needs to be, you know, perhaps peacefully, quote-unquote, abolished because it's a racist, white, Western construct.
The whole idea of the American experiment, because there have been a lot of leftists have saying, like, this shows you that kind of how America is based on oppression, exploitation of people of color, and there's a kind of left-wing view that America can't survive because of that. And then there's also right-wingers who would have that view for different reasons. So just to kind of see what will happen in the long term. Yeah, I mean, kind of the long-term trends. One scenario is we could just ironically, we could just go back to like the 70s and 80s, like more white flight to further out exurbs and more kind of like law and order Republican type policies, like more cops and more jails.
Where is the support for those law and order policies going to come from? I mean, I think there's like a black pill to be taken. I hope that not that he's done a great job, but I hope that Trump wins in November. And I hope that maybe we'll elect a strong Republican will be on the ballot in 2024.
These like really big horrific events are always turning points in history. So World War II combined with a lot of the social turmoil of the 60s kind of led to the liberal order of the later 20th century. So it will be interesting if this event will dramatically change society or we'll go back and or we'll kind of go back to the same thing that we did in the later 20th century, where we'll have like law and order, Republicans, and white flight to the suburbs, versus a left that wants to maybe kind of address the grievances. So there's all these different trends, but I do think what is different is that whole era of white flight to the suburbs and building and increasing more police, more prisons and jails back in the 80s, like 80s and 90s. And that was an era of where we did have a lot of prosperity, and we're not going to be prosperous as a nation. Our GDP is shrinking, mass unemployment will be poorer. So I don't think that necessarily is sustainable. But so, yeah, I mean, it's really hard to picture the predict, mm-hmm. but I don't think like this whole kind of idea, Americanism and liberalism, and that we're one society, that we're in it together, I do predict like more like neo-tribalism. People will find their group and be more loyal to their group rather than society as a general in general. So that's what we'll likely see.
I don't know though. I mean, we talk about that on this show, but I don't know if there's really...
It is really bad for urbanism, so that's been something we've talked about a lot. This whole kind of... Well, there has been this trend where a lot of the urban proletariat has moved to these exurbs, these places. Like, you have all these towns popping up in the desert. And a lot of that, I mean, a lot of it is as a reaction to gentrification of the urban cores. But I do think this, along with the virus already was, I do think, like, overall, I think this will be, like, really bad for urbanism.
Definitely, yeah.
We're getting closer to the end of the show. Just kind of, like, to talk about what will happen in the short term and the far-out future. So there's these kind of large-scale, like, well, these large-scale events that have happened, and that has been, I mean, that's incredibly destructive. will happen over the summer, so yeah, I mean, I don't see the current situation as last is going on over a long period of time, but what I predict that will happen in major cities like LA, I predict just like an overall like rise in crime and looting, and just an overall decline in quality of life, like this event, the lingering effects of this event, and then just the overall economic decline. So, yeah, I do predict like a massive decline in major urban areas. This is probably like the biggest could very well be the biggest crisis in our nation's history.
I think that the scariest thing about this is that both sides are going to leave feeling completely validated in their views. Our side, you get dissident right, kind of, this proves just how dystopian things are getting and just how bad some of these demographic shifts and culturally leftward shifts are. It proves just how bad those things are and just how bad they can be for normal Americans like business owners. And then on the other side, you have people who, for whom this is absolute proof, the fact that he would even countenance sending in the National Guard, this is absolute proof that Trump is a fascist and that there's a real risk that we're on that we're teetering over into dictatorship. Validated.
The whole thing about like civil liberties is because like the whole thing about declaring Antifa a terrorist organization, like Glenn Greenwald, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, he kind of expressed that civil liberty concern. And also from a kind of like how it could set like a precedent for any dissident group to be called, labeled by the government a terrorist organization. So that's kind of civil liberty concern. But the thing is like that kind of mindset about creating like a fair and just society, the problem is like that kind of goes out the window in a conflict like this.
Yeah, no, totally. It goes out the window. As you said earlier, it's a harsh reality pill, and we just have to kind of shore up and realize kind of where we stand. And it's not going to be a perfect from any kind of ideological standpoint. We have to realize, you know, who has our interests at heart and who is actively antagonistic toward us.
Yeah, I mean, as a nation, we're in a really bad situation, so...
Really, really terrible spot. And I even people who are trying to take, like, the most extreme stance, like, oh, this is time for the U.S. to split up into different parts or something, even that, there's no like glimmer of hope as to how that would work in a functional way. I mean, this is all very bad, basically. But it's also, the other point I want to make before we conclude is that it's also a lot of this stuff. Are there any real new insights here, or is this just kind of what we've been saying would happen for a while?
Yeah, people have been predicting this kind of social unrest in the case of an economic breakdown. Like dissident thinkers and different like alternative, you know, a lot of political intellectuals, but most, yeah, like your average person, I guess, like there's these people, like they just think that we can basically that the 90s or the 2010s or whatever, or the in between era, like we'll just continue that for the next century, and like some people,
I mean, that's
literally
out the window, yeah,
yeah, yeah, like some people literally feel that way.
Okay, so we're doing this show, and I feel like I'm kind of going back and forth between trying to sound, going back and forth between being base and going kind of more soft and nuanced. And it's a really hard. You were saying, Robert, that you've always, you know, struggled with that on your show. You know, how to hit the right balance between base and nuanced. And it's a really hard thing to do. But I think it's God's work. I think it's the exact thing that we need to do in light of what's going on. I mean, these riots basically validate every hard right point you've ever come across on the internet. Like,
they do vindicate some hard right points. Yeah, they do, but they also vindicate left wing points about economic inequality.
Yeah, they illustrate points about the existence of that inequality, but they illustrate points about the existence of that inequality, but at the end of the day, what we have is a mob, and all the nuance in the world doesn't change that fact. And I'm all about, you know, defending civilization, however imperfect and however flawed it has been over the decades and since the founding of America. At the end of the day, as a person of the right, I see the attack on civilization, and my instinct is to defend civilization. So this is what I'm talking about. You have to find the right balance between I think being from maybe this is not your perspective, Robert, but it is my from being very firm on that as you know defending civilization, being firm on that while also taking a nuanced, dare I even say objective view on what is going on and how it can best be quelled.
So yeah, I mean, I basically made my major points. But Matt, it was great talking to you. And yeah, I mean, we'll definitely have to do a follow-up on this.
Yeah, great talking to you as well.